Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to the Hyperion Hub, your meeting place for all things Disney. Now your hosts.
Hello and welcome to the Hyperion Hub, your meeting place for all things Disney. I'm John Alois and I'm joined by Sean Dagenhart.
Hey there.
And John Redling Schaefer.
Hi there.
And hello there. Wherever you're listening to us, please rate and review so more people find the show. You can email us at podcast@thehyperionhub.com. I'd love to hear from you. Podcast@thehyperionhub.com.
He's lonely. Please
yes,
email
please.
Him.
.com. Follow us on social media as well. It's a special episode. This past Sunday night, the Wonderful World of Disney celebrated Disney 100. We're going to kick things off with our Disney views. Let's throw it over to Sean.
Kitsch. Okay, we've known it was coming for several months, but the Once Upon a Studio short premiered, and I was unable to see it live because of some family commitments, but it was simply amazing. I kept checking Disney Plus all night, and then eventually woke up at 4 in the morning on Monday. I'm like, okay, it's on. I'm speechless. It was laughter. It was a world of tears. It was just absolutely perfect. It is exactly what it should have been.
Yeah, very emotional. When we found out you hadn't seen it yet, John started private messaging me to talk about it
because he didn't want to spoil it. I'm going to look out from under the bus.
He didn't want to spoil it, which totally makes sense. And look at how understanding he is. Anyway, so tremendous, spectacular. What other words can you use?
Brilliant.
I thought it was
neat.
Perfect.
Cool.
Yeah.
Perfect is the word.
From open to close, everything about it, the idea of these characters, this Disney animated cinematic universe of characters coming together to take a once-in-a-lifetime portrait and mimicking what the animators had already done. Wonderful.
The mix of 2D, 3D, and the memories it invoked from your childhood through your parenting, with multiple generations all commenting back and forth about their favorite parts. It was a magical, 10 to 12 minutes that I've now watched way too many times to admit.
The humor in it was just, it was amazing. Mm-hmm. The whole Flash and Donald thing.
That was my favorite. As far as humor goes, that was, I thought, the funniest moment.
And the minute you saw it begin, you're like, I know exactly where this is going, and I can't wait to see Donald's reaction.
Well, I empathize with Donald. You know, he and I are soulmates, and you're right. I mean, that and getting smothered by Baymax is everyone's nightmare, isn't it?
And hearing the original voices, many of the original voices, and it was just, can't say enough about it.
You know, I sit here as the lawyer going, well, working with the Robin Williams estate to use his original sound recordings and all of the paperwork that probably went into that and others that they, you know, maybe didn't own per se, but it was just amazing. You really enjoy watching it by yourself, with your kids, with your spouse. It's just something that I know won't be deleted off of our DVR for a very long time.
My problem was after I had seen it and then showing it, I showed it with two of my girls before they went to school, and then the next one got up and we watched it, and my problem was not wanting to, I was wanted to say stuff. Like,
right.
Okay, that's so-and-so, and Bernie Mattinson, he just passed away recently, and he was the longest employed Disney cast member, and, you know, all those kind of things, but just seeing their reactions too, because they responded differently to different characters.
Right.
You know, depending on how we grew up. I think Ralph's comment when he, after he banged into the door and he said, "No problem, Garfield," cracked me up.
It has to be some sort of tribute.
Oh,
yeah.
Definitely.
I don't know how you were able to talk. I was sitting there watching. The first time I saw it was with my wife, and then I watched it with my daughter later when Mickey walks up to the Walt portrait, and we see the reflection of Mickey and who's playing the piano recorded for this short.
Richard Sherman on the piano that is in Walt's office that he was asked to play it on every Friday when they would go into the studio, you know,
feed
into
the
Walt's
birds.
Office. Oh,
yeah. Amazing.
That was a wreck.
My favorite moment is at the end when Oswald tips his ears to Mickey and Mickey says, "After you." I get goosebumps even thinking about it because Oswald's such an important character. I'm so glad he's back under the umbrella of Disney.
Prince Charming losing his shoe, and then yelling at Eric, "Eric, get your dog!" You know, those kind of things. Hearing the iconic Goofy laugh.
Yeah, fix it, Felix, fixing the camera. Yeah.
And there's your Maui. Mix of new and old. I think that's great. I like the ensembles, the Peter Pan group coming through, the Pooh characters coming through, the fact that they could interact with, you know, themselves a little bit, but then with the others, it was just great.
And every character that was featured were featured in a way that highlighted them perfectly.
Exactly.
Like Eeyore. Well, you'll see in another 100 years.
Of course, he and Grumpy have to lament together, right?
Right. But then when it panned up to Alan O'Day, you know, playing just a nice melancholy When You Wish Upon a Star, and you just feel it building and feel it building. And then when Jiminy takes over and they went back and grabbed the original you know, vocal tracks with Cliff Edwards. Mm-hmm. And, oh,
yeah.
Amazing.
Perfect. It really was.
It's what we wanted.
And you were just there. I mean, how cool was it to see
that? That was neat for Clara and I, because we went back and looked at our pictures, and I'm like, there's the cafe where Merlin was, you know, serving tea. And so that was neat to have stood in the stairwell of the Sorcerer's Hat, and it was great.
I just realized, so the where Peter and everybody flies up to, that's inside
that's the Sorcerer's Hat.
I haven't been in that building. Oh, that's spectacular.
Yeah, I assume you pulled on the doors.
That building was it was off limits when I was on the campus.
Hasn't stopped you before.
I couldn't get anywhere near it. Trust me. Well. We also are celebrating Disney's 100th anniversary, and we're starting off this new series talking about the 1920s. We're going to go decade by decade over the course of this next year, and we will highlight moments from each decade and talk about it. For this first one, for the 1920s, we're going to go backwards a little bit, because I think it's important to take a look at young Walt Disney and how things that he experienced actually influences the company today. Something that happened to him at 4 years old had an effect on theme park building 50 years later. So I just think it'd be cool to look back a little bit before we get into the 1920s. If at any time you feel you need to chime in, please shut me up.
He didn't really seem convincing on that. I think he wants to run with it.
He told us off camera.
You're out of here.
All right. We're going to start with December 5th. 1901, Chicago.
We are going backwards.
Yeah, what, Chicago,
can you go much
Illinois.
Before that,
I'm you not can gonna... actually. We will go back to June 24th, 1893. But first, let's start.
Would you pick a date?
Getting whiplash.
December 5th, 1901, in Chicago, and Flora and Elias Disney live in Chicago because Elias, of course, was working on the Columbian Exposition and the World's Fair in Chicago, and that's where Walt is born. And he has older brothers, Herbert, Raymond, and Roy Oliver Disney, who was born on June 24th, 1893. That early life in Chicago, Walt doesn't have a lot of memories of, but his older brothers do. And in fact, the family ends up moving because they are concerned about city life. The brothers are starting to get in a little bit of trouble, and they just want to move out to the country. And along with the brothers comes Ruth Disney, Walt's sister, who is 2 years younger than him, and she becomes his childhood companion. They move to Marceline, Missouri, and his father ends up becoming a farmer. This is a romanticized moment for Walt. From age 4 till 10, Walt Disney remembers this time as being the most wonderful moments of his childhood. He doesn't have to work. He and Ruth are the only two that don't work on the farm, so he's free to explore. There's a train depot in town. He falls in love with trains. He loves playing with the animals. He starts experimenting with art, and he's drawing. In fact, there's a neighbor who pays him some money to draw his horse. We see later in life how much Walt loved small-town America based on Main Street USA and other aspects from Marceline. His father has typhoid and he recovers, but he can no longer farm. So they have to keep moving west, and they head to Kansas City when he's 10 years old. And this is where life gets really tough for Walt. His dad owns a newspaper route, and he and his brothers deliver literally hundreds of newspapers. Walt is working more than he's going to school. So not as many fond memories of Kansas City as you would imagine that he had in Marceline. He loves vaudeville and discovers the cinema in Kansas City. His best friend is Walt Pfeiffer, and I think the family, the Pfeiffers, kind of take Walt in and bring him to some of these venues. And they introduce him to storytelling and entertainment. And Walt was obviously very appreciative of all that, just being able to see these shows. Elias thinks it's a waste of time. However, he's not totally cold, as we've read and heard about. He pays for Walt to take art classes while in Kansas City, and Walt is exploring his creativity. The money Elias makes from the newspaper route allows him to invest in a jelly company, Ozell, back in Chicago. So Flora, Elias, and Ruth go back there. 15-year-old Walt stays in KC with his brother Herbert. He gets a job as a news butch selling soft drinks and newspapers on a railroad. And now, once again, he rediscovers his love for trains. Later on, one of the main reasons for building Disneyland is because he wants to ride in a train around his theme park. And it all starts while he's on the railroad in Kansas City. He moves back to Chicago at the end of the summer, and by this point, he knows he wants to be some sort of an artist. He starts drawing cartoons for the school newspaper. He's showing a lot of talent. And if you ever look at some of his early artwork, it's crude, but obviously he has some talent there and some skill.
And it definitely has that early 1900s animation style look to it, newspaper editorials.
And ads and mm-hmm. Very modern day women, what were they called? Flappers. I mean, he's drawing these types of everyday life. You're right. Drawing political cartoons about the Great War happening in Europe. At 16, he wants to join the cause, and there's a great sense of adventure in going over to Europe. And so he wants to be part of the Red Cross. He has to be 17, though. His mother signs his passport application, but Walt changes the year of his birth to 1900, so he can go over there. He and a friend are Red Cross ambulance drivers. And of course, this is the first time he truly sees the world. And Walt matures tremendously while over there. In 1918, Germany signs an armistice. Walt stays and helps with post-war cleanup. He begins smoking while over there. He continues to draw. He sends home drawings to magazines. Nobody will purchase them, but he's still continuing to work on his art. He returns home in September 1919 to Kansas City, where he wants to be an artist. Elias isn't thrilled. He tells him he can't make a living that way. Roy had served in the Navy and returns home to Kansas City too and begins working at a bank. Roy, obviously very good with money. He's much more level-headed. Walt's trying to be a cartoonist for newspapers. He gets a job at the Pesman Rubin Art Studio, where he meets Ub Iwerks. And they begin a small company together called Iwerks Disney Commercial Art Company. And some people thought this was actually an eye doctor's office, Iwerks Disney, on the sign. Walt leaves Ub to handle the company on his own, and he goes to work for the Kansas City Film Ad Company. He discovers animation there, and Ub eventually joins him, which means their little company kind of just fades away. Walt borrows a camera and begins working on his own animations in the shed behind his house. He's working on little puppets, and he's taking photos and obviously moving the puppets slightly. He calls them Laugh-O-Grams, and he sells them to Newman Theater in Kansas City. He begins recruiting artists and creates Laugh-O-Gram Studios. They're modernizing fairy tales in their stories. He's having a blast making stories and experimenting with film, running things in reverse. There's a great shot of his mother catching a newspaper with one hand. So they're just having a blast kind of discovering the craft. Herbert leaves and goes to Portland. Roy is out of the house. Walt's parents and sister both all leave for Portland, so Walt's alone, and this isn't an easy time for him. He loved that full house in Kansas City, but he pushes forward. purchases a film camera and officially opens his studio in May 1922. And they're creating ads and continuing to experiment. Here he eventually makes Alice's Wonderland. The Fleischer brothers, who go on to make Popeye and Betty Boop, they had placed their star character, Coco the Clown, in live-action scenes. And Walt decided to place a little girl in a cartoon world. And that little girl, Virginia Davis, it was a great idea, and he sold it, but he signed a bad contract, and halfway through production, the company was out of money. Just not very business savvy at this point. Way too trusting. In July 1923, he sells the film camera and heads west to Hollywood, where he wants to become a director. He has $40 in his pocket and boards a train with no leads whatsoever. He's 21. He's wide-eyed. He's naive, but he feels free.
He said he had $40 and a suitcase and a...
and a dream. There you yes. go. Yes. I think it was a cardboard suitcase. Suitcase, wasn't it? He does have an uncle there. Robert lives in Southern California on Kingswell Avenue in L.A. He's literally going from studio to studio to see if they have anything. He said he'd sweep the floors, and he's failing miserably. He didn't want to go into animation. He felt he was too late at competing with the big studios in New York. But he eventually comes to a conclusion. It's what he knows best. So Uncle Robert allows him to use his garage as a studio, and he continues to work on the Alice comedy.
I love that you mention his Uncle Robert, because he has a very important role to play in the creation of the Walt Disney Company. You don't hear about Uncle Robert very often. But multiple Disney websites on October 16th, 2023 reference a four-page contract dated October 16th, 1923. The articles, depending on which website, is pretty much the same. Here's how a four-page contract started the Walt Disney Company. And it's a wonderful look of a very simple contract, again, signed in his uncle's Hollywood home. And on that date, Walt signed a contract with Margaret Winkler, a New York cartoon distributor. The innovative silent cartoons known as the Alice comedies, which were made between 1924 and 1927, about a real-life girl going on adventures in a cartoon wonderland, was a major success for Walt, and both Walt and Roy used that as the seed of the Disney Company as we know it today. Much like our esteemed host here, I would like to backtrack just a moment and tell a little bit more about the woman who took a chance on Walt. So, Margaret Winkler, she had a film company named MJ Winkler Productions because, heaven forbid, as NPR put in his article, that people find out a woman was running a business. Yeah. My goodness. She was a Hungarian immigrant, 18 years old when she began her career in entertainment as a secretary for studio executive Harry Warner. She learned the ins and outs of the film business and in 1921 left Warner to found her own production and distribution business. She turned her first cartoon, Felix the Cat, into a global star. A savvy promoter who understood the business side of creativity, she sold the series both domestically and overseas, regularly spinning her success to the trades. Her most significant contribution was her talent for identifying and building a market for short films. Now, by contrast, and again, this is an article from NPR, Walt Disney was a struggling cartoonist. Laugh-O-Gram Films was nearly bankrupt. He still held out hope for a project that featured a live-action character named Alice interacting with animated characters, including her cat, Julius. According to Disney, in the summer of 1923, Walt used some of his last $40 to buy a first-class train ticket, as we discussed, where he and his brother Roy O. Disney...
First class. You've no money. You might as well go out there in style.
If you're going to go for it, you go for it. What is a first-class train ticket get you in 1923? Does that give you a seat? You know, versus sitting in steerage. So he and his brother Roy would work on, obviously making films, as you said, out of their uncle's garage. Now, in a letter to Winkler, who was based in New York, Walt wrote to her, "In the past, all cartoons combining live actors have been produced in an amateur manner. It is my intention to employ only trained and experienced people for my casts and staff that I may inject quality humor, photograph, and detail into these comedies." She wrote back, "If your comedies are what you say they are and what I think they should be, we can do business." So before signing the deal, Walt checked Winkler's responsibility and standing with her former boss. You know, why not do a conflicts check or a quality assurance check? "She is responsible for anything she may undertake," Warner responded. "In my opinion, the main thing you should consider is the quality of goods you are going to give her. And if that is right, I don't think you need any hesitation in having her handle your merchandise." So that led us to October 16th, 1923, where they signed a deal to produce and distribute 12 episodes of Alice Comedies. And as the Disney Company says, this contract is considered the founding document of the Walt Disney Company.
She's a huge deal in New York, and she's the first female executive as a distributor, too. And not only was she working on the Felix the Cat series, but she's also working with the Fleischer brothers and their Out of the Inkwell series as well. So this is a big deal for Walt, too, mm-hmm. just to work with her. And obviously she knows talent. And he ended up sending her the unfinished, I assume it was a print of the unfinished film. And she felt it was a great investment for her. On October 15th, she replied with this telegram: "We'll pay $1,500 each negative for six, and to show my good faith, we'll pay full amount each of these six immediately on delivery of negative."
Without a signed contract. My goodness. That's taking a jump, isn't it?
She obviously knows talent. Roy is in a hospital with tuberculosis. Walt runs to the hospital excited. He's worked out this deal to finish the Alice comedies. Roy leaves and never goes back. And as you said, on October 16th, 1923, they signed that four-page contract. I was surprised Roy's name isn't on that contract.
Well, and I don't know if that was by design. You know, that may be the savvy guy going, yeah, you put your name on it. I'll help you out later, right? I got a credit report to worry about now. It is interesting. You know, I see contracts today with, you know, four pages is nuts when you think about it for something like this in today's world. There's no way that's a four-page document.
Well, the contract that I had with Disney for the Cinderella score is 33 pages.
That seems short, right?
Right, and that's for 500 units.
Well, and again, you do still see the basic contract formalities. You see, you know, the identification of the parties. Unfortunately, they're only letting two pages be available. I'd like to see the whole four-page document. The witnesses. You know, ordinarily you would say, I have authority to act on behalf of the company. Well, obviously there was no company in terms of Walt at that point. The witnesses, I mentioned, you know, Uncle Robert was Walt's, but the other witness for Winkler was Charles Minst, who later distributed Walt's Oswald.
Right.
So it's interesting that there are still some, you say Roy's not on there, but there's still some big names
absolutely.
On that contract.
Yeah. And this is the start of the Disney Brothers cartoon studio. This is where it all begins.
And thinking about just even in like the time we're in where we can DocuSign things and, you know, instantly have, you know, a proof of one of the shorts, whatever. But think how much time had to pass in shipping things and waiting for contracts to arrive in the mail.
Assuming they got there.
Right.
Wait, there's no proof of receipt? How do I get that? Yeah.
Yeah. And we'll talk about Charles here in a moment. Walt buys a secondhand camera.
We're setting him up to be for the evil Charles Mintz.
He buys this
we'll
camera
talk about
for
him.
$200 and moves into a storefront in an office down the street from his uncle's place on Kingswell Avenue.
And Robert goes, thank goodness, I can park my car inside.
Car in the garage again.
Give me a beer fridge.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I can watch the game out here again.
Cubs are really bad this year.
1923.
Probably.
A couple years away from the World Series. Yeah. He convinces Virginia Davis and her family to move to California so he can finish the film and continue the series. Then he convinces Ub to move out there as well. And Ub's a huge influence.
And just think of the persuasive prowess he had to have to do that. I'm going to take the world by storm with this, you know, this is not a perfected technique.
Was that all done, I mean, by letter, by telegraph? I mean, think about the wording he has to use to convince someone to drop everything and go how many thousand miles to follow a
whole
dream.
Family.
To follow his dream.
Right.
Not even theirs.
Right.
He has a contract. There aren't any animation studios in Hollywood, so I'm sure this is all very appealing to somebody who's talented and understands that this is the start of something big. With all that going on, Walt and Roy move in together across the street from Uncle Robert's, and it's
they're back again.
Small upstairs area, and they annoy the heck out of each other. I think it's Walt who's making dinner, like, you know, bean soup or something every single night.
First, over a candle or something.
The first Odd Couple is born,
yes.
Right?
Yeah. Roy can't stand it. In fact, so much so, he proposes to Edna Francis, whom he knew from Kansas
just
City.
Out of desperation.
And
don't tell
accepts,
her that.
She accepts. They get married in 1925 at Uncle Robert's house. Walt falls
Come on, in, man. Would you go somewhere else?
Walt falls in love with a young ink and paint artist at the studio named Lillian Bounds.
That would never happen today.
And eventually he would propose months after hiring her, and they got married in
what did HR say about that?
Lewiston, Idaho in 1925.
Is that where she was from?
She's from Idaho, okay. Yes. I don't know if that's the town, but in July.
Why don't you know?
I'm sorry.
Seems more like a Coeur d'Alene name family, if you ask me.
In July of 1925, the brothers put down a down payment on a new lot on Hyperion Avenue.
Hey.
Yeah.
That sounds familiar.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
I'm starting to put things together now.
Margaret Winkler would marry Charles Mintz in 1924.
Dun, dun, dun.
And he took over Margaret's distribution company after she retired to raise a family. He was much tougher to work with.
That's weird. The Disney article doesn't really dwell on this part. Go ahead.
He was demanding and didn't like the budget Walt had established on the Alice comedies.
Well, he and Roy could have a couple things in common then, yeah.
He didn't like the shorts really at all, and so Walt agrees their time has come to an end, and now Walt needs to create his first animated star. I couldn't find any documentation to state who created the character, but the studio comes up with Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Mintz, the distributor, sells the Oswald shorts to Universal in March of 1927. Oswald's first film, Poor Papa, is rejected by Universal. They thought the quality was sloppy and Oswald looks old. So Walt's learning, you know, people do want to see quality. If they're going to invest their money, they want not only to be entertained, but they want a certain level as well. So Walt and Ub worked on another one, Trolley Troubles. Oswald and his girlfriend Hortensia are a huge hit, and it allows Walt to grow the studio staff. In February 1928, the Oswald contract was coming to an end, and Walt wanted to renegotiate, so he and Lillian took a trip to New York City to meet with Charles Mintz.
Dun, dun, dun.
Mintz wants Walt out of the picture. He undercuts him, offers him less than the deal they had before. He tells him if he doesn't sign, he's already poached his animators, with the exception of Ub, and Universal owns the rights to Oswald, so Walt has nothing. He gets ready to come home, but before he leaves, he sends a telegram to Roy, and it reads, "Leaving tonight, stopping over in KC, arrive home Sunday morning, 7:30. Don't worry, everything okay. We'll give details when I arrive. Walt." Do you think Walt was worried? I think he was petrified.
He was probably hoping the How many days train ride was it that he would calm down by then?
I give him credit for not worrying his brother. I give him credit for trying to calm himself down with that message. And you're right, Sean. I mean, 5, 6, 7 days. I don't know how long it would take. He's of the mindset that I've got time to come up with something between New York and Los Angeles. Don't think he could do that on an airplane ride, but you know, plenty of time.
Now, there's a lot of legend in this next part, and I'll describe what Walt said. He said his next big character popped out of his mind and onto a piece of paper while on the train coming back to California. What I think actually happened after reading many different sources is I think he did have an idea for his next character to be a mouse, and I do believe he thought the name should be Mortimer for whatever reason. No offense to anyone named Mortimer out there.
Yeah, we got a bunch of Mortys that listen to this show.
It is.
There's a whole swath of them out there in Manitoba that listen.
It is well documented that Lillian actually did name the character, and she did not like the name Mortimer, so she came up with the name Mickey. Walt gets back, and he still has to finish his obligation with the Oswald cartoons with a bunch of employees who basically stabbed him in the back. And in secret, he and Ub work on Mickey Mouse and the Mickey Mouse cartoons. Imagine that. After hours, Ub's behind closed doors, locked doors, working on this new character for the company.
Our first foray into industrial espionage, huh?
Mickey and his girlfriend Minnie's first films were Plain Crazy and The Galloping Gaucho, but they didn't test well, so they couldn't find a distributor. For the third film, Steamboat Willie, Walt decided to add sound, a new concept in movie making. It wasn't the first cartoon to use sound, but Walt found a way to make it superior to the others.
Synchronized with the actions.
Yes, with a click track, I believe. He made a deal with Pat Powers, who would supply the sound equipment to the theaters as well as distribute the film under Celebrity Productions. Walt provided Mickey's voice. It was funny. One of the sources I have for this is Walt, the man behind the myth, and they mentioned how Walt was trying to direct folks into Mickey's voice, and he kept saying, no, it's not like that. It's high, but it's not falsetto. And finally, someone just said, well, why don't you just do it? And so he did. Mm. So that's how Mickey got his first voice. Steamboat Willie premiered at the Colony Theater in New York on November 18th, 1928 to rave reviews. Mickey was an overnight star, and with a star finally under his belt, he was on to his next endeavor, and we'll see that as this story goes on. Walt is constantly thinking about what he wants to do next. So next he experiments with music and animation, and the studio began producing films under the title series Silly Symphonies. The first one in the series was called The Skeleton Dance, released in August 1929. It doesn't have much of a plot. It's basically skeletons emerging from their tombs and then dancing, and comedy ensues. It's fantastic, in my opinion.
And that was pretty much just to show off, hey, look what we can do. We, you know, sure. can synchronize all this.
And perspective and everything else. Audiences must have been floored watching this in the theater. It's a very strange cartoon, but what a way to kick off the series. There were Silly Symphony cartoons that followed to close out the decade. This is where we'll end the 1920s, and it's amazing to me. Walt signs this contract. He has no idea if he's still going to be in business in 5 years, in 2 years, because nothing he's done up until this point has been successful. The difference? He has big brother Roy, who is kind of looking out for him now.
Also has no idea about what's to happen in October of 1929 mm-hmm. as well. Financially.
Sure, of course. Interesting point. We're going to hear in the...
Write that down.
I'm out here.
Mic drop. We're going to hear, though, that the stock market crash doesn't hurt the studio as much as we would think, but that's because, you know, Americans are looking for entertainment at that point. But you're right. He's not planning for anything. Well, I mean, they're in a depression, so they're trying to get their minds off of things as well. He doesn't know how to plan for the future. He never has done that before, really.
So and not much changed for him, really.
Exactly.
When you're broke, you're broke.
Zero plus zero equals zero.
And he just takes what he has and uses it to develop his next idea. Pretty remarkable, really. Mm-hmm. Sources for this episode include Walt Disney and American Original from Bob Thomas, Walt, the Man Behind the Myth, a film directed by Jean-Pierre Isbouts, the Walt Disney Family Museum in the Presidio in San Francisco, California, the Walt Disney Hometown Museum in Marceline, Missouri, WaltDisney.org, and D23. All right. Well, if you think we missed anything from the 1920s, go ahead and email us, podcasts@theHyperionHub.com. Follow us on social media, and wherever you're listening to us, please rate and review. It really does help more people find the show. Till next week, have a great one, everybody.
We're glad you could join us. We'd love to hear from you. You can email or send us a recorded audio message at podcast@theHyperionHub.com. Find us on social media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Hyperion Hub is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company or its subsidiaries. We'll meet you next time at The Hyperion Hub.